Forgot her name.
We'll leave the names off to protect the innocent.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
What's going on, Cherry?
Not much, but we can do the same bit.
Okay, so we got to come up with our own bit.
We need our own bit. We have a bit. Do we need a bit, though?
I don't think we need to do anything that anybody thinks that we should do. I'm going to go our own way, man. So what do you want to talk about? We want to talk about missing the point.
We're going to talk about missing the point.
So who wants to start?
Well, how do you want to start? I think we should start with you thinking about...
That was wrong. I was launch in.
I think we should start with you talking about how you've missed the point. Or should we talk about why we're talking about missing the point?
Let's talk about why we're talking about missing the point.
That sounds good.
So today we are talking about missing the point. And you and I think, both have some observations that we made in the past that demonstrate this point about missing the point and what do we mean by missing the point. And just to give some context, I came across this when I was reading Rob Bell's book, Love Wins, recently, which I just picked up after I think everybody else has already read it. It's like one of those things I'm finally getting around to.
When did it come out?
I think, I don't even know, quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Like 2011? 2011, I think?
2012?
We can edit this,
so that
we can edit this later. And there was a statement in there, which I should have brought it over and I could actually read it, or in fact, I might have. So much of what we see around us is seems to be an exercise in people missing the point. And I think he was talking about this in the context of churches, church-going folk, what congregations sort of tend to do. But my friend Sherry, say hi, Sherry.
Hi.
have talked a couple of times about this so far, and we both have myriad examples of what we think of as people missing the point. And so I thought it would be fun, or Sherry actually thought it would be fun, if this was actually a title. I don't know, I said hi. This was entirely your idea.
Well, and part of it was because it wasn't just like, so you started with missing the point, and then you mentioned it to me, and then I started seeing it elsewhere.
Yeah,
as well.
I said I was going to make it a wall poster or something, you know, put it on a t-shirt or something like that.
So it showed up in my Lenten devotional, like the day after you mentioned it, the fact that people miss the point.
Which I hear went over well.
Well, the devotional was just something I read, but then I wrote something based on it because missing the point kept showing up. Yeah.
Do you want to start about that, or do you want to talk a little bit about how you saw it? And what prompted you to write this missive for your devotional?
Well, so there's the devotional that I do because it's Lent, and that's what we do in Lent, is we tend to have daily practices. So I'm reading through this book that a pastor of mine has given me, and like the very day after you mentioned mentioning the point, the theme of the day is missing the point. So I saw that. And then every week I write it's like the only writing I do weekly is I write a call and response call to worship for my church. And so this call to worship was sort of around Mark 10, which you had also been thinking about Matthew 19.
Yeah, I was looking at the Matthew 19 version of it. Yeah.
They're basically the same. Yep. And so, like, there's this kind of, the universe is conspiring here. The church is preaching off of Mark 10. And so everything, I can't see the passage without thinking about what we've been talking about missing the point. Because, you know, it's a bunch of people in Jesus's day wandering around, like, trying to figure out, like, how do you earn the way to heaven or whatever. But everything they're talking about, they just keep missing the point. And so what I wrote for the church was just basically a meditation on that, of how they miss the point, but then not letting us off the hook either, because we all miss the point all the time.
And I think pretty soon we'll eventually have the conversation of what is the point anyway, as we see it. We'll get to that. We'll get to that later. We'll
get to that before we ask that question.
Yeah. So, what is the point?
Yeah.
And when I think about missing the point, I was thinking back to an earlier example from my life where shortly after 9/11 in 2001, there was in my hometown of St. Louis. Right. I'll just put that out there. A large gathering before a Cardinals baseball game of spiritual leaders from all over the St. Louis community who were coming together to, in remembrance, in an act of solidarity, in an act of community building, all faiths represented, you know, all spiritual traditions represented, to show unity, right, as this new, you know, ominous danger and trauma and catastrophe is now part of our lives. And there is one particular very prominent church group in St. Louis, which is of Missouri to begin with, didn't go. And they didn't go not because it was inconvenient for them. It was more of a boycott situation where they disagreed with some of the other tenets of some of the other religious faiths that were present. They didn't necessarily feel like they wanted to be lumped together with these other groups. And, you know, the first thing that I sort of thought is, wow, I think they're missing the point. Uh-huh. You know, this is not an opportunity for evangelism for any particular faith. You know, they're not missing out on an evangelistic moment by doing this. They're missing the point. They're absolutely missing the point of standing together in the face of adversity. You know, and that is sort of transitioned for me into what I see when I walk around, you know, a college campus and I see how what people are doing, what things are doing, what's happening in classrooms and what happens in administrative buildings. And I just sort of think, wow, there seems to be a lot of people that are really kind of missing the point of the way that I sort of see it, which means there's either something wrong with me or something wrong with everyone else. And I think it's everyone else.
Well, and I think that one of the reasons we both are thinking about missing the point is, I don't know, maybe I'll only speak for myself. But I think for me, it comes up because I think I spent a long time missing the point. And so the more I can see where I've missed the point, then on the particular subjects that I've missed the point, I can look at, you know, I can look at my students or I can look at others in my community and see the ways that they're missing the point that I'm trying to recover from specifically. So, Paul, how have you missed the point?
I missed the point. That's a question, you know, and since I've known we were doing this, I've sort of thought about it. And
it's like I gave you homework.
Yeah, homework. I'm not sure if I did it.
That doesn't surprise me.
That misses the point. Right? Mm. So,
rebel.
Well, I remember when I was, you know, growing up in high school in a private, you know, parochial high school, you know, I think there was serious dissatisfaction with the way that I sort of saw the way that things were going, the way people treated each other, the way I was being treated, the way anybody was being treated, you know, the actions of the people did not sort of line up with the doctrine that we were sort of exposed to on the daily basis. And, you know, it took me a long time to sort of recover from that to the point where when I look at it, I think, well, if that's what this faith is, and to live it as I saw it being lived, then is the point. And not only do I miss the point, I don't want to get the point, you know, because if that's the point, that can't be it. That can't be what the intention of this is. More locally in time, anyway, to where I am now. How have I missed the point? You know, I found myself when I first started teaching in the classroom, not knowing very much of what I was doing, you know, fresh off of a PhD, you know, teaching a class with kids in front of me for the first time, going through, you know, the Krebs cycle, photosynthesis.
Did you teach during your PhD?
I was a TA.
Okay.
And soon after that, I taught a couple of large lecture classes, mm-hmm. As an instructor before I was brought on as faculty. Well, I'm a content specialist. I'm going to go to my classroom and I'm going to give them all this awesome context and content. I'm going to explain the book to them and I'm going to go through this book chapter by chapter. We're going to make sense of all of this kind of stuff and they're all going to leave my class being scientists and they're all going to do really well on the exam. And, cause I mean, multiple choice is a thing, right? Testing tells you what you want it to. It's a wonderful way to, you know, to investigate whether or not students are learning. So I really don't know what the problem would be. And it didn't take me very long, to realize, by that I mean a couple of weeks. Well, really, it only took me until I got the results back from test one, wondering, you know, with all this fancy schooling I did and with all this fancy learning I've done, you know, with all the thought into how to show this concept, how to demonstrate this one. And so many Fs, you know, very few scores above 50% on this thing. Again, it's like, well, there's either something wrong with all of these kids or there's something wrong with me. And in that case, it's like, maybe this isn't what this is supposed to be. You know, maybe I'm not, my primary role is not a content specialist. Maybe my role here is not just to, you know, help them understand the textbook and assign homework for them to do outside of class and to just kind of do this rote sort of methodological way of thinking what it means to be a college professor in one way or another. Oh man, Sherry, I think I missed the point. Mm-hmm. I think I've completely missed the point. And I think you're making progress on this when you look back on this and where you are now and you say, I'm actually not sure what I'm supposed to be doing here, I think is a good sign for any faculty person to find themselves at.
Well, it's interesting because, like, I think, you know, you did all the things that were supposed to be right. Oh, like, yeah. you were lesson planning.
Extraordinarily well.
But I think lesson plans miss the point. I think one of my mentors, she really chafes against having objectives for, like, a class because she says, who am I to tell my students what they're allowed to learn? And I think that actually hits the point, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think learning can be planned for in the way that we like to think when we learn how to teach.
At the end of this lecture, my students are going to know A, B, C, and D.
But what if they learn Q along the way?
Yeah, and what if you realize that for them there's something between A and B that makes perfect sense to you but doesn't make perfect sense to them? You know, you sort of have to reserve the right to be surprised.
Right.
You know, and I found that I'm very willing to abandon any idea about how I think a class is going to go as soon as I walk in the door, you know, there are some times when I walk in and it's like, I don't know what we're going to do today. We're probably going to talk about something about cell division, but other than that, who knows where it's going to go, you know, and to direct a class in a particular direction, with tight bounds and objectives so well defined limits, I think, you know, you're going to end up. The best thing you can do in that case is the minimum amount that you intend to get to with no chance of anything interesting happening.
Yes. So last semester, I came to you about halfway through the semester and I told you that my classes weren't going well.
I remember.
You asked me whether it was one of my classes or if it was all of my classes. And I told you it was all of my classes. And you told me that if it was one of my classes, it might have been the class. But if it was all of them, then it was me.
What are my wiser moments?
What a good friend. And I think you're right. In retrospect, it was definitely me. And the semester I'm having this semester, and what's changed definitely shows it. And I think ultimately I missed the point. So my colleague and I planned our first semester composition classes very carefully together. We wrote amazing assignments together. And we spent a lot of time thinking about what we would do in the classroom. And then I met my students. And my students were not the hypothetical humans I imagined with the hypothetical backgrounds that I had assumed. And so then as soon as we got in the classroom, everything just fell flat. Because I was rehearsing a part, but they didn't know their role in it. They were doing something else. Mm-hmm. And so the whole, I couldn't teach within it. It was a really hard ship to steer because I was trying to plan for predictability. And that's not what actually can happen. That's not how I'm best as a teacher anyway.
I don't think I am best as a teacher that way either. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think you and I are, I don't want to say that we're so unique, but it takes a certain level of comfort with venturing into the unknown. It's like, we'll see what happens, you know. I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe it'll sink. Maybe it'll float, you know.
But
what it does do, right, it gives you're better able to meet your students where you are with that approach.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah, I think so. Because I think I was going into the classroom with a script and, like, these are the things we have to get done today. And I wasn't seeing the people in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times when people are missing the point, they are failing to see the people in their community. I kept trying to do the same thing. But now this semester, like, I'm going in being like with the mantra of accept what shows up and let it unfold. And so that means I have to go into the classroom and say, who's here and where are they at? Where am I at? What do we need to get done? Where are we going? Where are we going together? It's a different conversation than what I was having last semester.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And certainly a different one that I find myself doing than where I originally started in this career path sort of years ago. Because, I mean, the way that I had always thought of it was, you know, I'm the teacher of this class. So I'm going to lead them down this path to whatever knowledge base they're going to actually embody. And it's not you're leading, but you're leading as a guide as they find their way down. I'm not even sure the best way to sort of describe this. You know, you're walking with them on the path. You're not telling them how to go, right? You sort of have to. You're better served sort of telling them what the destination is, and it's like, great, how do you get there? And that might be different than how this other person gets there. And so if the point is to be a content specialist, you know, when I say this in my class every once in a while, just use the book, just read a book. You know, you don't need me for that. You're never going to be as much content rich, you know, than your textbook is. And if your objective is to, you know, be a content provider to your students, your aspiration is to be a book. And it's like, you're never going to do that. The best thing, you know, the book is always going to be a better book than you are. So your job can't be that.
No.
Your job can't be that. You know, it's got to be something else. Mm-hmm. It's got to be something else. You know, and I would say, I would reiterate what you said so well, you know, that it's about, you know, responsibility to the community and, you know, how they are interpreting what you're saying as a collective and the role that you're playing in their understanding of things, as opposed to you just telling them what to, you know, understand the Krebs cycle, understand mitosis. And that's not going to do it, because there's all kind of questions they have around that, you know, about how this fits into their own lives and their own existence. And you're better served by interacting with them on the context of where they're coming from than in the context of where you want to go. So like you said, you're actually looking at the students as opposed to looking at the chalkboard. Or the, even worse, the PowerPoint slide. Right. You know, as you sort of go. So what is the point? You know, what is the point? And does it change, you know? We know how to miss it. You know, we know what it feels like when we feel like we're getting the point.
Right.
You know, the point is what exactly?
Well, I think it depends on, well, I don't know. Because I think missing the point always has to do with community. And because just how the way I frame the world, like we're sitting right now in my office where I have a sign on the wall that says spread kindness, build community. And I have that sign on my wall because it helps me remember what I think the point is. And I have it to be the first thing that I see when I walk in the door every day, so that maybe I'll remember this day to not miss that particular point.
That is not the first thing that I see when I walk into my office.
No, it's not.
I see piles of stuff that I need to clean up and reminded of my own shortcomings as
an
organizer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what's born of that, right? So what is born of the community that you build if it's only to, you know, to be disbanded in 17 or 16 weeks? You know, what's the lesson learned, you know, through doing that, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's the hard part. I don't know.
That whole, what are they taking from this, you know, experience, you know?
Right. Well, I think if you do it, I don't know. It breaks my heart if I finish a class and don't carry with it, from it, a relationship. Like every semester I meet humans in my classrooms who I will know. So far as I can tell from the 13 years of experience here, every semester I meet a human that's going to come with me on the journey.
Yeah, I think I probably have as well.
Yeah.
I think I probably have as well.
But there are also, I mean, that's the other part of it, is like when you're building a community, like you have to be okay with the fact that there's going to be people in the community that are going to miss the point and they're going to opt out.
That's true. Yeah, some people don't want the point.
No.
Some people just want 3 credits of A and then on to the next one, you know, yeah. And I think that is fundamentally missing the point.
As an undergrad, do you think you were, what were you looking for in your classroom? Like?
God, I don't even know, you know, now we're in the way back machine. I don't know if I had the emotional intelligence to know, to even address that. It's like you know, when I went to college, I mean, it was never even a conversation we had in the house. We all went to college. It's, I mean, that's what you're going to do. You know, every person in my household is a college graduate, you know, only one of which didn't have a master's degree, at least. So it was always just sort of assumed that it was going to happen. And it didn't, my parents, to their credit, didn't care what I studied. Mm-hmm. They didn't care, you know, where I went. You know, they didn't want me to break the bank. But at the same time, you know, they'd, you know, go where you think you'll do your best kind of thing. They only cared that I went, you know, and didn't get F's and everything, which I'm proud to say that I didn't.
So what did you understand to be the point of going?
I don't know, right? I think it was to satisfy a given understanding of the way things are done, you know? And I did enjoy my undergraduate experience. I did like what I was studying. I was a biology major. I really enjoyed the classes. You know, I didn't do microbiology and immunology and the cellular stuff because I preferred the organismal, you know, bigger mammal, reptile, ecology, vertebrates, you know, the macro scale kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So within the context of what I was studying, I certainly had some parts of, oh, yeah, I really like that stuff. That stuff's cool. I'm going to study that kind of stuff. So there, I certainly was blessed with the enjoyment of the experience from a fundamental level. You know, I didn't wander aimlessly not knowing what I wanted to do. I wouldn't say that I was self-directed in this by any means. I mean, yeah, everybody flops around a little bit in their first year. But I settled on biology quite successfully pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And I took great pride in finishing that degree because I did what the people in my family, right, are supposed to do with that. And I didn't have the worst time doing it. And, you know, I did have a pretty good time in college. I did have some pretty good friends. I did have some good times. Mm-hmm. The true sign of this is I do actually know people today who I went to undergraduate college with. I don't have too much contact with people that I went to high school with, you know, because that wasn't not understanding what the point was. That was thinking I knew what the point was and me actively rejecting what that point seemed to be. It's like, I am not, if that's what the point is, I'm actively rejecting that. I was not in it to build community. I was not in undergraduate college to do all this kind of stuff. And I did okay. I sort of discovered the importance of that a little bit later on, I think. And when I was in graduate school, I kind of figured that out a little bit. And things did get easier from there, for sure. I'm not sure, you know, and I do know for a fact at the time I was not thinking, what's the point of this? You know, but in those days, college was cheap and jobs were plentiful and money was money was cheap, you know, so it's not like there was no existential conversation to have about whether or not this is worth, you know, $100,000 in debt. You know, it's like, is this worth $15,000 in debt for this entire degree? It was a whole different conversation then. And a job was available to me when I left, and it wasn't all of this other kind of culture that it is today with it. And I think that probably has a little bit to do with this too, though. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the day, I don't think you needed much of a point. You know, because it was cheap. Uh-huh. And I mean, that was room and board and tuition for 4 years for under 20 grand. You know, this is a state school in Missouri. It's like, there's no need for is this the best way to spend my money kind of thing? Because at worst, you had student loan debt that you paid off in 5 years afterwards after you had the job, which you were most likely going to get.
Well, even the way the system was set up, like people could go and navel gaze. They could go and take whatever classes they really wanted to and still get FAFSA money to take whatever classes.
Yeah, money was free and cheap.
You know, and now, like, the point is to get only the courses that will help a degree. And so there's no room, you could be rudderless in college and someone was still going to help you pay for that, but you can't. You need to get straight to the point.
Yeah. Now. Yeah, and if college is a journey of self-discovery, it's a very expensive journey.
Yes, yeah.
It's a very expensive journey, and one that is far more expensive than it used to be.
Well, that's my college experience. Like, I think my undergrad years, like, if I was going to talk about missing the point, it was totally those years. So I did my bachelor's degree in 3.5 years, and my master's degree in 1.5 years. I sped through, I did a 5-year BAMA program, speeding through as quickly as humanly possible. Mm. Almost all of the classes I took were in the English department because why do anything else? Why become a well-rounded human? So I took like the bare minimum of anything else I had to take, and I only took English classes, and I just sped through. And I did not really build community. I mean, I had my husband and I went to college together. He wasn't my husband then, obviously, but I had like a very close core group of people, but I wasn't interested in the other humans. I was interested in getting the degree and getting out of my hometown. Like, right. That's all that mattered to me. And so I got so caught up trying to be good at this thing called college because I had been told that I was very average all through high school. And then I got to college and somebody told me I was good at this college thing. So I became very good at it and just threw myself into work. But I just got on this like treadmill at a particular pace and never asked myself, why am I going so quickly? And I see that a lot of times with folks I work with, like, what's the rush? I was rushing for a really long time to get to a destination that I don't think ever existed.
Mm.
I did my PhD in 4.5 years, which, you know, is not necessarily a normal PhD length either. And my director used to always say, well, what's the rush? I still can't tell you what the rush was, but I felt an existential rush to get somewhere. And now that I'm full professor and I have the PhD, I'm 36, what was the rush?
Yeah, I say that to my students all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I got to get out of here in 2 years. No, you don't. You're fine. You know, what's the rush?
Yeah.
You know, do you know what it's like after you leave here? Oh, my God. You know, if you knew what it was going to be like, you would not rush to it.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, that what you said really kind of triggered a thought in me. You know, what is the, when you think about it, you know, what is the point? When you think about, you know, the treadmill and getting on to a thing where you start rushing in a particular direction to a place and never actually getting there, you know, I think that kind of plays into this. When you think about, is somebody missing the point? You sort of think about, okay, if this is the way this is going to go from here, you know, what is the outcome of it? I mean, if the spiritual organization is going to boycott the spiritual gathering to show solidarity and community that is clearly suffering, clearly traumatized, clearly in pain, how's that going to play out? You know, how's it going to play out in the long run? Let's say so this becomes a thing, right, where if you disagree with others in your show of solidarity, you're not going to go. You're going to take your ball and go home. You know, what's the end point of that? How does that play out? You know, it leads to an unsustainable place where it's just us and everybody else and you otherize everybody, you know, and you're isolated in your community by self-imposed, you know, walls that you've built up around everybody else, you know, when you see the students and they're trying to get out of here as quickly as possible to get on to the next thing, you know, I tell them to slow down for a couple of reasons. It's like, take your time. You're going to miss it because there's a lot of fun you can have. There's a lot of interesting things you can learn. A lot of experiences out of the classroom that you're going to have that are easier to have now than later on.
Mm-hmm.
And if your goal is always to get to the next thing, which you see as the next step, you're always going to have that. You know, you're never going to be happy where you are. You know, you're always going to be looking for your happiness in the next thing that you do. And the next thing you know, you're going to be old, miserable, you know, wondering where the time went and why you're not happy. You know, you never are happy when you were. Yeah. You know, you're always looking for the true answer to be on the next thing.
I think this is why, I think there's a lot of research that shows that right after people finish like their PhD or a particular degree, they automatically like steep into like really, really heavy depressions. And it's like, cause if you haven't identified that next thing, you're toast. Like there's, because we just get on highs on not being, we aren't good at just being where we are. Right? Presence, right? So we have to know what that next thing is. Growing up, my father used to always say, we are not human beings, we are human doings. And I took that to heart for a really long time. And that's, I understand true. His essence, like what he was trying to say. Like he wanted us to be productive, but I took productivity to a really unhealthy place. And so I have been reteaching myself to be a human being, instead of a human doing. Because otherwise, what's the point? Like, what's the point of being a human doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great for industry.
Yeah, it's great for industry. I mean, it's loaded up on coffee, 16 hours a day, assembly line, you know, put the sprockets in the in the hole. Yeah.
I'm actually not a widget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. Yesterday, we had a fire alarm, right? Remember the fire alarm yesterday? Beautiful day, blue sky, sunny, warm, you know, and even after the fire. And so, you know, fire alarm goes off, you got to kick everybody outside under the horrible, awful 70 degree sunny blue sky, you know, March day where we had. The groaning that you hear from the students who are inside the building, realizing they have to stop what they're doing and go outside, was disheartening at best. It's like, it's a beautiful day. Go outside, get some sun for 15 or 20 minutes until the all clear comes out. Mm-hmm. You know, my God, you have this wonderful, you know, the universe just gave you an opportunity to go outside and get some fresh air and a little bit of sun on an otherwise day, you know, stressful day full of studying and indoor book learning. It's like, just go outside. You know, it's like, should we take our stuff? It's like, no, just go outside and stand in the sun and say hi to somebody that you know or don't know. Make a new friend if you don't know anybody else out
there. You know what's funny, though, is that faculty can fall into that same trap.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I happen to have run into my friend Paul during that fire drill, tried to convince him to go for a walk, and he said he had an
email
to go write.
I had stuff to do.
Yep, mm-hmm. I think you missed the point, Paul.
Well, I engaged in it pretty well prior to that.
Yeah, that's
fine. I mean, I think I 4 or 5 students came up to me and, hey, Paul, hey, what's going on? You know, and we, you know, tossed the rag a little bit. But, you know, a cadre of the kids that I know that did go outside for the fire, because I mean, everybody went outside for the fire drill, you know, grabbed their book and went outside and sat at a table and got right back to the studying. It's like, no, you don't do it that way. You just kind of put it all down for a minute and look at something farther than 2 feet away, farther away than
the
page
of
the book.
See the fire
drill
as a gift.
Because, yeah.
It's a gift.
I saw it as a gift. It's like, yes, fire drill, yes. Vacation, yes. So no worry for 15 or 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So to that, I saw that as being the point. It's like, you have this great opportunity to go do something else for a minute and get some fresh air and walk around, you know, get a little bit of sun on you, you know, if that feels right to you. Perfect. You know, and if you don't study for those 15 minutes, 20 minutes, who cares? Who cares? You know, and that's the wisdom that comes from experience with this.
Yeah.
It's like your career path is not going to be based on 15 minutes of the fire drill if you get some sun instead of putting your face in this book, you know?
I'm really starting to think that periods of no productivity or low productivity or seeming unproductivity are the most productive parts of my day.
How so?
Well, so like one of the things, so I used to come to work, teach my classes, grind through and go home, right? And I would always repeat the phrase like, I don't have time for X, Y, or Z, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'd love to have coffee with you, but I don't have time. So I have like a couple things during the week, including one thing I do here in the office, just hosting tea. Which is totally not productive. It's not what we are brought here to do. So I put on hot water and I invite randos across the campus to come hang out with me in my tiny office and drink tea. And it's some of the most productive time that we spend. But it's not the point. It's not why we're here.
You pack this room, too, when you do that.
I do pack it. Like, don't tell the fire marshal, right?
Yeah, I think you're over the allocated number
of humans. Well, we spill into the hallway, right? But it's an unproductive time, but, you know, I think it ties back to community. It helps us remember, you know, accidentally we remember the reason we're here, right? And we remember what we're trying to do together. New collaborations are forged. But that doesn't happen if you just have your nose to the grind all the time. The cool, like, we wouldn't be doing this if I didn't go to one of those things. Like, we go to the salon, right? Yeah. And I think you and I became friends because of salon.
I think we did, yeah. We can blame a librarian for that.
Yes. So a salon, for our listeners, do you want to explain what a salon is?
Oh, you'll do a fine job of this.
Will I?
Switch one. Salon
so one of our librarian friends hosts the salon, which a salon is just a gathering of folks to discuss ideas, And I think the first time our dear librarian friend brought this up, he mentioned that it's supposed to be an exchange of ideas with an engaging host. And he chafes against the engaging host part, but he's a delightful host.
He's a delightful host.
Yep. So he gathered a random selection of people who I guess he thought, you know, were looking to do something more than just clock in, clock out. And so we gather at a local watering hole.
Establishment, yeah.
And, you know, we used to have, every time we went, like a topic we were going to talk about.
We did that like once.
Yeah, like the first time I went, I made three men talk to me about rom-coms. It was delightful.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we did the AFI 100 Best Movies list or whatever.
Yeah, it was man, these men are missing the point.
Yeah, yeah.
It was delightful, though. But I think, you know, that, although the attendance for that ebbs and flows, like, we have a good group of people.
It's a good core, you know.
Who are looking for something more than just clocking in and clocking out.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be the majority, though, you know, and I wonder why that is, you know, how... I mean, are they missing the point, or do they have their own point? And we're missing theirs, you know, how universal is the point, you know, and for that to be the question, I sure found a lot of other people, I think, who agree with me on what the point is, as well as I can even define it, which mm-hmm. was, hey man, we're all in this together. Let's build some community and try to get through it as best we can. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the point to me. And I wonder what the price to be paid is to those amongst us here, right? Who are, mm-hmm. who are outside of that or don't feel like that's something they could do. Or don't even ask that question.
Yeah. Well, I know before I start, like, I would say before this year, maybe last year, for a long time, like, I'd been looking, I wanted to get a different job because I was not happy in my job.
You said that, yeah.
And I know a lot of people who are looking for other jobs. And I know people who have become part of these unproductive communities whose job satisfaction has greatly increased because they have unproductive time with their peeps. So I think sometimes communities have to forge their own points together.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that looks like looking off script of, you know, what is the organization or the church or whatever group you're in? What's the stated objective? But what do humans really need is like not always what the mission statement says.
Cafeteria food?
Mm.
I think they're missing the point.
Oh, yeah. Did you just fill out that survey?
I did fill out the survey. Yeah, okay. I expressed my disdain with a couple of things. And I'm not saying the food is bad. It's not, we need to get different risks because the food is bad. You know, I think they missed the point, right? I mean, this is just something, you know, the college and its best, you know, best interests of ongoing functionality and doing its service to as it's supposed to be done provides caloric sustenance, right, to its populace, both faculty, staff, you know, and students and everybody.
They would provide those pills from Willy Wonka if they could.
If they were smart, they would just like a Soylent Green situation.
Yeah,
I mean, there's this cafeteria over there, and what always kind of got my ire up a little bit is if you want to get anything that's a proper amount of food rather than like a side of something, which is, you know, sometimes those are actually kind of tasty. You're out, you know, $6 or $7, you know, maybe $8, you know, if you don't get the faculty discount.
Uh-huh.
However, you know, if you're looking for something hot and you go in there, you can get a couple of slices of, you know, junky pizza for, you know, $3.50 or some mozzarella sticks or some chicken fingers for $2.50 or something. And it's like, the point is not just to like put calories in people's stomachs with no concern for their health, formation of habits, well-being, obesity, hypertension, mm-hmm. you know, and the cheapest, most available things that people are most likely to get are the things that are going to literally put you in a grave before anything else and formulate bad habits with your eating that may take you a lifetime to sort of get out of, right? And that irritates me quite a lot.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot happening with just how we provide sustenance for our community. Especially when you think about the fact that a lot of our students just a year ago were in high schools around here where they were receiving free and reduced lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they can't come to campus. And, you know, one day I was in line behind a guy who was trying to decide whether he was going to get fried mozzarella sticks
yeah.
or 6 chicken nuggets. Not both, like one or the other, yeah. based on what he could afford.
Yeah.
And either whereas, way, he was going to spend way more than he would at a public school getting lunch.
Yeah, whereas something far more nourishing would cost way more. It's outside of the range.
Right. You know? Getting a vegetable over
getting
there.
A vegetable is, that's a minimum.
I'd even take a fried vegetable.
$5. You know, that's $5
some
minimum.
Fried zucchini yeah. straws or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I see that. You know, a lot of times I think when I see the bookstore, you know, I sometimes think it, you know, or it's not necessarily the bookstore. The bookstore is nothing more than a reification of what happens in the classroom, you know, but that comes with an expectation of, you know, hey, we're doing this class. Go to the bookstore and buy yourself a $100 textbook or rent one for not much less than that. That has this information, and at all of this information, by the way, is available on the internet for free. by the way, you know, so when it's like go buy these, you know, this huge, you know, science tome that has all the stuff in it, it's like I think they're missing the point of this. You know, it's not to, again, it's not to shove information at somebody. You know, it's to provide context around it, to provide community around it. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest advantage I've seen in my classes with taking effort to build community within the course, right, is that it gets students comfortable interacting with each other, mm-hmm. both inside the class and outside. Mm-hmm. And my kids that I had in my class last semester, read my blog. They still smile, run up, hug, you know, each other when they see themselves mm-hmm. on campus. And they're not in the same class. They're not in a class together any longer. Those bonds that they were able to forge have carried over, you know, mm-hmm. past the end of the semester and finals weekend and the new one. But those classes become more active. They became more engaging. Mm-hmm. Students said they always felt free to speak, you know, yeah. speak their mind, speak their opinion. They always felt free to ask for help because they saw the class not as being a place that didn't challenge them, but definitely being a safe place where they could have challenging conversations mm-hmm. that weren't always comfortable, mm-hmm. you know. But if you don't have that community, if you don't have that trust that you're looking out for their best interest outside of just being a content specialist, you're not going to have that. And the greatest risk of all in this is that they make it through their college career without having those challenging conversations mm-hmm. And having the opportunities to learn from them.
Because that's part of the point.
Yeah. And the downside from the administrative point of view is if you chew up your class time like that, you might not get through all those chapters that you're supposed to by the end of the year, to which I say, I think you're missing the point. Mm-hmm. You know, we're supposed to be challenging them not by the sheer volume of information we're shoving into them. I think we're still thinking to be challenging them to expand their boundaries, push them further, let them explore their own limitations of thinking and find ways to have conversations about what those limits are. And what the basis for them might be.
And there's some interesting ways in which you can look around our campus and see the physical manifestations of the way they miss the point in that way.
Yeah.
So look at our classroom design.
Oh, it's the worst.
Right?
It's the worst.
Our classrooms are not designed to set people together in groups, talking to each other, looking at each other. None of that, right? I spend a lot of time pushing against how my classrooms are set up because I need my students to be able to be in clusters together. I need them to be able to stand. I need them to be able to move around. I need them to be able to be in a big circle together. My classrooms are hardly ever conducive to any of this.
Mm-hmm.
So we lose precious classroom time just trying to manipulate the physical space because the physical space isn't designed to build community.
What's your ideal classroom setup? You walk in the door and what do you see?
I walk in the door and I see desks in a U shape.
Mm, all of them in one big U? Or
one big U. And part of that is so that I can stand at the opening of the U and I can move and get to any human, right? But they also need, and one of my...
I could work with that.
Yeah, see? and then the desks need to also be on wheels so that they
yes.
can move
yeah,
and get into I small agree. Groups. But the other advantage of that big U is there's a big open space in the middle where we can all gather and still have, where we can cluster around a desk and write, but then we can also be together in a shared space. Then we can also go and sit down. I can sit down. It's multi, and they can see each other. Somewhere in that room, there will probably be a projector screen. but, you know, probably something to write on.
Probably something to write on. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you walk
in
the classroom.
And multiple things to write on around the room so that they can be in groups, not all clustered at one board. Yeah. What about your ideal classroom?
Well, when I took over CG220, you know, 4 or 5 years ago and turned it into a student center, it's like I found every dry erase board I could and put it on the walls. And I got the hexagon tables that come apart that are on wheels and chairs on wheels. It's like this, just a truly modular, adaptable space for anything that anybody would sort of need it to be. And we would sort of, you know, we kind of, with a glint in our eye, said, let's screw with these kids, you know, that were coming in here. So every couple of weeks we would change up the table. You know, the way the tables were arranged, you know, went from the hexagons to squares, went over to a big round circle, went to a U, went to, you know, so we would sort of screw with them every once in a while. It was funny because they would walk in the next morning and like, what the hell? I don't know, you know, what my sort of ideal would be, you know, that U shape certainly would work, but I know that my least favorite is when you walk into the classroom and it's columns and rows. The only thing you're really guaranteed to see is the back of the head of the person in front of you. Mm-hmm. That's not a way to facilitate conversation whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the way that I think a lot of new faculty walk in the room and start teaching is in response to the way that room is set up. So what if a new faculty person walked in the room and it was a big U shape? They would probably freak out, walk out the
Well, and you know what's
interesting? The door. That changes the whole expectation, though.
Yes. Well, and it's part of my U shape preference has to do with my graduate training at Virginia Tech, because I did a graduate certificate in preparing the future professoriate. And I did a class on contemporary pedagogy, and it did a number of things that I think made me who I am in the classroom today. But that class, she taught the class in a giant kind of this weird lecture hall that could hold probably 60 of us, but it was like those kind of modular desks. Mm-hmm. And every day, the first thing she did was come in and put it in a U shape. And I was always like, oh, this is like such a, you know, pain in the ass to have to do. But in the end, like, we looked at each other. I knew the people in that room. And so she taught us to, like, we had to lecture in a, you know, 400 person lecture hall. Mm-hmm. We had to project our voices. We learned a lot from that. But my favorite, like, because I learned to teach in a room that was U-shaped, it shaped the way I think the classroom should look.
Interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. The first lecture class I ever taught, like, truly as I am done with my graduate degree, I am now a member of the profession, you know, one way or another.
A clear
academic. Contract job. Yeah,
contract
job back in where I went to graduate school. It was a class in natural disasters, had 250 people in it, stadium seating, microphone, you know, 30 foot screen in the front. And it's like, well, welcome to teaching, you know.
Welcome to the Paul Show.
Welcome to the Paul Show. So from the beginning of it, it was always the Paul Show, you know, because it's like, I'm not having an intimate conversation with 16 people. You know, I'm having a conversation with 250, and never did I ever feel like I was lecturing at 250 people. It's like, no, I'm in a conversation with 250 people. And so from this, you know, I think about where, because people ask sometimes how my teaching style sort of developed. And I always say it's a mishmash of Freddie Mercury and Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden. There was this interview that Bruce Dickinson did about, you know, what does he think about while he's singing, you know, Run to the Hills, right, from whatever album to a stadium of 80,000 people? He said, you're giving that concert to the person sitting in the very back row, right, who got the cheapest seat because that's all they could afford, right? You're not doing the concert for the loaded folks up in the front, you know, that are in the fan club. You're doing that for everybody, you know, even the person in the back row. So sing to them. You know, and they will be right there with you the whole way. And I've always found that to be the case. And I've never had any trouble whatsoever, even in classes 200, 250 people, getting people to contribute in class to, I'll call names. And if it's a class of 250, it's like, I'll just write 10 names of, the name of 10 students on a piece of paper and take it with me. I don't need no 250. All I need is 10 to put 10 the fear into them, you know, and then they open up really well. But they have to feel like it's safe to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, students I know from, you know, I've asked a couple of them over the years to weigh in on this. You know, there's risk in opening your mouth in class. Mm-hmm. There's risk in that. And they're not willing to do it if they think they're going to be wrong, or if they think they're going to be seen as being an idiot, or, I mean, their words, not mine. Mm-hmm. They don't want to embarrass themselves. It contributing to class discussion and having the risk of not being right has consequences in high school now that it didn't used to have before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, I was wrong all the time, and I had no consequences whatsoever. And it's riskier now, I think.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I tell my students, because we talk about this at the beginning of my classes, because my classes are pretty, well, they're not as small as they could be, but, you know, they're pretty small classes and people get to know each other, and I expect everyone in my classroom to talk. And so we talk about the challenges to get to that, and almost every semester, almost every class, they say without fail, their biggest fear is looking stupid or mm-hmm. saying something stupid. And so I always try to tell my students that, like, that is part of where that is the point of my job, because it is my job. It's a very improv-esque thing. It is my job to say yes and to whatever they throw to me. Mm-hmm. And even if it is oddball, even if it isn't exactly right, it is my job to always make them look good.
Yeah.
It's my job, because I have to help them stay safe in the space that we're creating.
Yeah, and what mindset do they bring in to think that if I open my mouth and say something wrong, then people are going to think I'm stupid?
Yeah.
I mean, my God, that's what's walking in the door. Yeah. And that's the meeting people where they are. It's like, have some compassion for these people. My yeah. God, you know, it's unbelievable.
And I mean, it used to hold me back as a teacher. Like, I used to go into the classroom worried I'd say something stupid. I assure you,
oh, yeah.
I say stupid things all the time.
Oh, yeah, I'm not worried about that. It's a guarantee. Every yeah. time I will.
Yeah.
Yep. It'll happen every time. I don't have to worry about that at all.
But I think the fact that I feared that for so long helps me be compassionate about where they are.
Yeah, and that hesitance, you know, that you get, you know, being concerned about doing it right, doing it the right way, really does close you off. It really mm-hmm. does close you off. You're not being open. You're not being welcoming. You're not inviting conversation from the student side or from the faculty side when you mm-hmm. do that. Oh, my God, I'm always worried about what I think. Then you're certainly not interested in how what you're saying is coming across, and you're certainly not listening, mm-hmm. you know, to what other people are saying.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
It's true.
It's true.
Interesting stuff. Indeed. Interesting stuff, you know, so I strive every day, I think, to, it's like biology, we'll get to it. You know, let's make a space where we can have a conversation about biology. You know, because if you're talking about biology without that, I don't think it's
yeah.
not going to hit. It's not going to stick.
Right.
they're going to forget you as soon as they walk out the door, and they're going to be on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, and as soon as your class is over, that's going to be gone. And then what was all that money for?
This is where I think I have an advantage over you, because my classes are about rhetoric. And the goal of rhetoric is to allow humans to do life near each other. That's the goal, right? So everything we do in our class is about, like, what do we do to make sure that we can use language so we can do life near other humans? So, mm-hmm. so many things can fit under that umbrella.
Yeah, I have to do a little more yoga to get to...
You do.
This is a biology class, right? It's like, trust me, it's fine. We'll get there.
Right.
So, yeah, you sort of engineer not just the physical space, but the community space mm-hmm. To be a place where conversations can happen. Then you can, I think, get to real work. Mm-hmm. I think you can really get to work when you do that. About any topic.
Yeah.
About any topic.
Because otherwise they think you're missing the point.
Yeah.
Right? They're point is you need to prepare me for this test.
Well, yeah, what are they thinking? Yeah, so they're thinking one of two things, you know, or one of many things. You know, either your job is to prepare me for the test. I've always thought the solution to that was very, very simple. Just don't give tests.
Well.
It's like, that's my solution.
I'm an English teacher. That's never been our thing.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I've learned also freaks people out. Uh-huh. It's like, oh my God, you're not, then how are you going to grade me? How are you going to evaluate me? It's like, oh, I have my ways.
Well, I still want to see your syllabus.
Well, they've been acculturated. They've been acculturated to expecting a quantitative score that they can identify themselves by and with and build self-esteem around for better or usually for worse.
Yeah.
Building that space, you know, around there where you can actually have those conversations and then you can talk about anything.
Yeah.
But if you don't do that, I don't think you can really talk about anything meaningful.
Right. Well, because I think it's hard to create that space in part because they often walk in with the expectation that the point is to build a GPA.
Yeah.
And that they are there to do the things necessary to build their GPA. Yeah,
the answer is a number between 0 and 4.
Yeah.
All of this comes down to a number between 0 and 4.
Right.
I think they're missing the point.
They might
I think
be
they're
missing the point. Yeah.
But that's the point that they've been told.
Yeah.
You know? And so I don't fault them.
No.
You know, for it. It's like everything about the way this whole system is constructed is to reinforce that as the point.
Right.
You know, look at the college admissions scandal. You know, how do I get my kid into this place? You know, lie, cheat, steal, swindle your way in, you know, as best you can. You know, just the whole concept of I'm going to cheat, you know, on this thing. I'm going to submit somebody else's work that is not my own. It's like, I think you're missing the point. You know, it's not about the number. It's about you as a person, not as a metric. You know, what is the growth that you're going through? What is the development you're having? Right. You know, how are you challenging yourself to push yourself to discover more about yourself? And that is never going to be something that's answered by the number, let alone a single-digit one, decimal or not.
What if our syllabi were based on measurements of personal growth?
Oh, God. I think we would live in a very different world if that were true, you know? I think we would live in a very different world and one, you know, not worse off than it is now.
I do try to play with an element of that in my classes. Like, I have a thing. I don't do participation grades because I don't know what that means.
Introverts, extroverts. You know, it's like some people are privileged by that. Some people are not. And
So I have a thing called professionalism. And at the end of the semester, they have to write a justification for what grade they think they earned in professionalism. And they build a case over the entire semester. And they can do lots of stuff to tell me that they're professional. But I think, you know, overall, it gets them to think about where were they when they walked in my door? And then where are they when they walk out the door? And have you made strides in becoming a better professional than when you started?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, I guess I do grade based on growth. So I tell them, especially when I have those come to Jesus conversations in the first couple of weeks of class where it's like, you are not getting the point of what we're trying to do here. Would you like to reframe? And a lot of times at the end of the semester, they can say, yeah, at the beginning of this year, I was really screwing up in these areas. And this is what I figured out. And this is what I'm doing now.
You actually have to have conversations with your students in order to do that, though, Sherry.
Yeah, well, that's all I've done all week, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, it is what you've done all week.
Yeah.
I don't have quite the luxury of that, but, you know, I do have conversations with them pretty much every day, you know, and I get through most people within the course of a week or two, but it's outside of the norm and definitely outside of the expectation. And I know a lot of folks who don't, you know, I see a lot of folks who don't, you know, we can finish this where we started this, you know, folks, you know, people walk in, teach their class, walk out, you know, in and out. And I worry that those students are not getting the full possibility of what they could. And if you ask, you know, grab 10 students off of the sidewalk out here and say, you know, what do you expect to get for your money that you're paying for tuition? It'd be really interesting to hear what the answers are. What is college for? You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to think of big, complex questions. What are you doing here? What do you think college is for? What do you hope to get out of this? What do you expect for the money you're paying? You know, and it would be really interesting to see what they said.
It would be just as interesting to ask the same questions to faculty and staff. What are we all doing here? What's our job?
What's the point of all of this anyway? You get feed my family, build my house, you know, I'm a content specialist, teach biology to the new generation, make a generation of informed voters, right? You get all the kind of usual suspects, I think. Yeah. I don't know. But
what do you think the point is, though? What's the point of education?
What is the point of education?
What are we doing here, Paul?
What a question is that? You know, our founding fathers once said. I was just
you
talking about this.
The point.
Yeah, I was talking about this with somebody else earlier, with a student. And again, I mean, this fire alarm was transformative for me yesterday in a couple of ways.
What a gift!
Because I saw many people taking advantage of that fire alarm in ways that was the point. And if you think about how most colleges and universities are designed, you have the different buildings situated around a quad. And each one of those buildings specializes in some sort of thing, you know, where you become a content specialist or you become familiar or you take economics in this room and you take literature over in that one. So, you know, I mean, this is the way this campus is sort of laid out. And most campuses are buildings around a central gathering spot where students don't gather, right? They're always studying or off somewhere or, you know, whatever, with your kind of face and a cell phone doing that kind of thing. It was so interesting to see in that fire alarm that quad was being used for its authentic purpose, which is a place where faculty and students can gather from multiple disciplines to have conversations to see where all these subjects intersect with each other mm-hmm. in new and novel ways that they haven't anticipated. You know, and I think that's it. You know, I mean, how do I learn about the current state of the human condition from the point of view of writing, from communication, from economics mm-hmm. and currency, from science and technology,
yeah.
you know, from what am I missing? Stuff, other subjects, you know, yeah. psychology, you know, pick any course content prefix you would like, right? And then what you should do with that is go outside and talk to somebody else about it.
Who's
coming at it maybe from a different perspective or one that reinforces what you think about it.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. I mean, how do you make connections
yeah.
between these subjects? And it breaks my heart to see college campus quads no longer sort of utilized to that. I mean, mm-hmm. you think of college campuses and why they're organized the way they are. Those people who did this were actually pretty smart, you know, and we've gone away from that. And, you know, the cell phone certainly hasn't helped.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it only takes a fire alarm, right, to reinvigorate, yeah. you know, the intended usefulness of these things.
But I think that interdisciplinary, like, approach of, like, thinking and comparing and getting different perspectives, for me, that's a big part of the point. David Foster Wallace has this commencement speech he did
mm-hmm.
Called This Is Water, and I use it in my classroom. And in that, he says that the true point of a college education is to help you. He has this whole metaphor where, you know, of, like, being in the grocery store and thinking that you're the center of the universe and that everybody's in your way. And so his point is that education is supposed to teach you that you have a choice for how you respond to situations. Mm. And I think that's for me, it is like college is about providing people with a variety of strategies for problem solving, for navigating the choices that they get to make as humans in life. And so we get a little of different things because different people see these are toolkits you can use to solve different problems right. you face as a human.
Right.
But I think we get too siloed, and that's where we miss the point. Like, why are we talking, Paul? I'm yeah. in the English department. You're a biologist.
It's not done. It's
right?
just not done.
Right. Countercultural. Just figure yeah. out what kind of problems can we solve by we getting our heads in one space.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting how similar of an approach we both have to this whole thing,
mm-hmm.
given the disparity of our, you know, the differences between our respective fields.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
That's going to be the last word of the podcast.
That's it.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
So I think we
yep.
figured it out. I don't know.
We did. Well, I think we have our point.
Yeah, I think I have mine. You know, I think I have mine. You know, and I, you know, really, I mean, I don't think about that when I wake up in the morning. I'm going to go in and I'm going to make sure my kids have interdisciplinary content that they can bring to their liberal arts friends far and wide. I mean, that's not what I think about when I show up. Mm-hmm. I want to go home and feel like I actually did something worth doing, you know, and, you know, I leave here, you know, as strange as the job is, with a pretty good sense of satisfaction on most days,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that satisfaction did not come from, man, I really covered a lot of great stuff in that lecture today. You know, it was, man, I really had great conversations. I really had good interaction. My class was vibrant. It was asking questions. It was engaged mm-hmm. with what was going on. They talked to me. They talked to themselves. You know, yeah. I talked to them a little bit. It shows the sign of a community, you know, mm-hmm. and that scale of 1 to 10 on how community was my day at Nova is directly proportional to how did I think this day went?
Yeah, absolutely.
How did I think this day went and how satisfied in me am I in the outcome?
Yeah.
Of it. It's like, because that's what it is, you know, it's a place where you go to explore the human experience. And every class that I teach, I tell the students the same thing on the day one. This class isn't about biology. This class is about you.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, by the way, your economics class isn't about economics. It's also about you. Mm-hmm. Just looking at it from a different angle.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what you're saying sort of triggered in me, like part of, you know, my week has been long because I do these student conferences.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
So
I
haul
imagine.
In every student that's in a composition class with me and I sit with them for 15 minutes and we talk about who they are as a writer. And it's exhausting. And all my colleagues are always like, oh, why do you do this to yourself? And one of the reasons I do it is because early in my teaching career, I went to this conference and there was this guy who referred to himself as a dinosaur. He was getting ready to retire. And people asked him, how did you grade all those papers for all those years and keep doing it? And he was like, because I remembered that behind every paper, there was an interesting human being. And when I took papers home, I forgot about the community, right? I forgot about who that interesting person was.
It turns into a stack. Right?
It's just like it's a transaction. Yeah. And so I bring these people in and they come and they talk to me and I look them in their eyes and I remember what's going on in their lives as much as I can. And we have conversations, and sometimes the conversation's hardly about their paper. And sometimes it's about, well, you wrote the whole paper the night before because you were dealing with this real life stuff. And how can we work on balancing that? It becomes a totally different conversation. But I think, yeah, at the end of this week, like, I will go home utterly exhausted, but my connection to human beings, like, you can't deny that. Like, So, yeah.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
I think we did it.
We did it. Yay. We did it, Paul. Paul and Sherry have a
Paul
podcast.
Paul and Sherry have a podcast. Yes.
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 You know, and we hope to do it again.
Yeah.
It'll be super.
Good job, Paul.
Good job, Sherry.
We did it.
Bye, everybody. Say bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Nice.